As we have considered questions that God asked in the Old Testament and questions Jesus asked in the New Testament, some of the questions may leave us scratching our heads saying, why did he ask that question? The answer seems really obvious. And this morning we're going to come across a pair of questions that Jesus asked that fit into that category. We see that maybe the answers aren't as obvious as we thought. In Mark chapter 10, the passage that was read for us earlier, Jesus and his disciples are on their way to Jerusalem. And they're going there for the last time in Jesus' ministry. He knew that when he went for the Passover this year, he would be the Passover lamb. He would be sacrificing his life on the cross. And he had tried to tell his disciples, and they didn't really get it. So they're on their way, and as they're coming from Galilee to Jerusalem, they pass through the city of Jericho. It's about 15 miles from Jerusalem, and this is where we pick up the story. The scene is set for an insistent appeal. Verse 46, then they came to Jericho. As Jesus and his disciples, together with a large crowd, were leaving the city, a blind man named Bartimaeus, that is the son of Timaeus, was sitting by the roadside begging. When he heard that it was Jesus of Nazareth, he began to shout, Jesus, son of David, have mercy on me. Many rebuked him and told him to be quiet, but he shouted all the more, Son of David, have mercy on me. Now, this is a miracle that was recorded in Matthew, Mark, and Luke. All three of those gospels record this event, but there are differences in each of those gospel accounts. Now, don't let that alarm you. When you see the differences between the gospels, that doesn't mean that one was right and the others were wrong. They had different perspectives, different vantage points. I mean, imagine there being a traffic accident in an intersection, and there are people on all four corners that witness the accident. As they are interviewed by the police, they're going to see some different things because of the perspective they have. And that's what we have here. Really, we can be thankful for these differences. Because if all the Gospels said exactly the same thing, we would not have independent records of Jesus' life. They would all be copying off the same source. So those differences are actually beneficial as they give us the whole picture. For example, in Matthew's Gospel, there are two blind men. He doesn't name either one of them, but all the details are similar to this story. Luke only mentions one, but he doesn't give the name Bartimaeus. Only Mark does. In Mark, we're told that this is taking place on the way out of the city. Luke says it's as they were coming into the city. How can we reconcile those differences? Well, let's begin with Jericho. Jericho is located about 5 miles east of the Jordan River, about 15 miles northeast of Jerusalem. There was an old Jericho and a new Jericho. And we even have that here in the United States. I remember a number of years ago, I was doing some family research on my mom's side of the family, the Rosses. And we found out that the first Ross coming to America came from England and landed at a place called Newcastle, Delaware. But when you get there, there's actually two Newcastles. There's Old Newcastle, which kind of retains the era of the 18th century. And then 3 miles up the road is the new Newcastle that has the more modern houses and buildings. And they're just two different communities sharing the same name. Same thing with Jericho. Jericho is an ancient city. It dates all the way back even before the time of the conquest. But in recent years, at Jesus' time, Herod the Great had built a new city that was called Jericho, and he had one of his palaces there, and it was a very modern city by those standards. And so it's very easy where Jesus and his disciples are coming out of old Jericho and going to new Jericho. That would explain the difference between how Mark and Luke records this. I'd mentioned earlier that Matthew mentions two blind men, Mark and Luke only one. And it's likely that the one that is mentioned in Luke and in Mark, by the way, Mark names him as Bartimaeus, was probably the more active one continued on with Jesus. As we're going to see, Bartimaeus, after he received his sight, you know, spoiler alert, says that he followed Jesus. And it is very likely that Mark included his name because he was a well-known Christian at the time Mark wrote his gospel. You folks would all know Bartimaeus. Well, this is his story. So again, it shows where it's not a matter of one being right and one being wrong. When we take all of the gospels together, we get the complete picture of what happened on this day. So as Jesus and his disciples are heading to Jerusalem, we come across blind Bartimaeus begging at the side of the road. He was one of society's expendables. He was a nobody on the road of life. His cries for Jesus, Son of David, have mercy on me, it was an embarrassment to everybody else. Have you ever been in a crowd and someone is either talking very loudly or maybe a child is making a lot of noise and you feel a little embarrassed, you know? You wish they would quiet down. And that's what these folks are doing. Be quiet. Shush. Quit yelling. Jesus is coming through and he's too busy for you. Don't bother him. But that didn't stop him. He probably yelled a little louder. Jesus, Son of David, have mercy on me. The Greek word there for cry out is the word for scream or to shriek. This is very loud, very disruptive. And even above the normal noise of a crowd, his voice is coming through loud and clear. He had set aside all dignity and restraint. He's screaming at the top of his lungs. And what is it that he's screaming? This is very significant. We read words on a page, but we may not catch really what he's getting at. He says, Jesus, Son of David. That phrase, Son of David, was a loaded phrase in those days. That was reserved for the Messiah. And you don't see it very often in the Gospels. But here he is acknowledging who Jesus is. This is the Messiah. And what was the Messiah going to do according to the Old Testament prophets? One of the things he was going to do was to restore sight to the blind. And Bartimaeus says, this is my chance. Here he is. I qualify. Help me. And he wasn't about to stop when the crowd was discouraging him. In coming to Jesus, I think we need some of Bartimaeus' boldness. We need to overcome our doubts, overcome our fears. Take that step to call out to him. Bartimaeus literally had never seen any of Jesus' miracles, but he still believed in who he was. And we need that kind of faith. Peter writes about it in 1 Peter 1:8. Says, though you have not seen him, you love him. And even though you do not see him now, you believe in him. Doesn't that fit our situation? We've never seen Jesus physically, but we can still believe in him. You may remember when Thomas made his famous statement after the resurrection. I won't believe until I put my fingers in the nail holes in his hands. Jesus shows up and says, here you go, Thomas. And Thomas falls to his knees and says, my Lord and my God, which in it itself is very significant. But what did Jesus say after that? Thomas, you believe because you have seen. Blessed are those who have not seen and yet believe. Bartimaeus literally had never seen Jesus. He had never seen any of the things Jesus had done, and yet he believed. And in boldness, he let his need be known. Someone once asked Helen Keller, "Isn't it terrible to be blind?" And she replied, "Better to be blind and see with your heart than to have two eyes that work and see nothing." And so it was with Bartimaeus. His eyes didn't work, but he could see. This brings us to an intriguing approach from Jesus. Picking up in verse 49, Jesus stopped and said, "Call him." So they called to the blind man, "Cheer up, on your feet, he's calling you." Wasn't that nice? They're telling him to shut up a minute ago. Now they're saying, "Come on, he wants you." Throwing his cloak aside, he jumped to his feet and came to Jesus. "What do you want me to do for you?" Jesus asked. That question might seem a little strange here. I mean, come on, Jesus. Isn't it obvious? This guy's blind. You're asking him, "What do you want me to do for you?" Actually, I think this is a very significant question. For one thing, it's not the first time in this chapter that Jesus asked it. There's an incident earlier in the chapter, and we're going to get to that later, where Jesus asked the very same question, word for word, but to someone different. And their answer was completely different. So maybe it's not such an obvious question. The blind beggar might want only money. He could have just said, "You know, Lord, give me enough to buy a meal. Give me enough to get by for a day or a week." This question, "What do you want me to do for you?" coming from the lips of Jesus, is the most important question God ever asks. And it's one which we often give the wrong answer to. We tend to ask too little. We tend to only see what's right in front of us. We're only thinking about the here and now. We don't truly ask God for what we need. We don't truly ask God for what he wants to do for us and through us. I believe Jesus asked this question because he wanted Bartimaeus to admit his need, to see if he would understand what Jesus could do for him. As I mentioned, we often ask far too little of God. Many times we're seeking just an extra margin of comfort in our miserable slavery to sin instead of what Jesus really offers, and that is forgiveness, mercy, and grace. We just want to make things a little more comfortable now. Now, Jesus could have said, "Well, it's obvious what you need. Let me fix it for you." But he didn't do that. He gives every person respect and allows them to exercise their freedom of choice. He asks, "What do you want me to do for you?" There's another incident in the life of Jesus that reflects this. It's over in the Gospel of John. John chapter 5, beginning in verse 1. "Sometime later, Jesus went up to Jerusalem for a feast of the Jews. Now there is in Jerusalem near the sheep gate a pool, which in the Aramaic is called Bethesda, which is surrounded by five covered colonnades. Here a great number of disabled people used to lie, the blind, the lame, and the paralyzed. One who had been there had been an invalid for 38 years. When Jesus saw him lying there and learned that he had been in this condition for a long time, he asked him, 'Do you want to get well?'" Come on, Jesus. Are you serious? Do you want to get well? Who wouldn't? The answer is an awful lot of people don't want to get well. You almost Catch that in the answer this man gives. "Sir," the invalid replied, "I have no one to help me into the pool when the water is stirred. While I'm trying to get in, someone else goes down ahead of me." Almost like, oh, poor me. I'm a victim. No one's here to help me. He didn't even answer the question. Jesus says, "Do you want to get well?" I kind of get the impression this guy liked being a victim. He liked other people feeling sorry for him. He liked other people doing for him, or he wished they would. Apparently, there wasn't anybody to take him down to the water at the prescribed time. But he didn't even answer the question. I think Jesus is asking a lot of people today, do you want to be well? You know, we sang the first hymn this morning, "Would you be free from your burden of sin?" We think, well, that's an obvious question. Everybody would say yes. Really? An awful lot of people that would just as soon stay where they are because they like it. A very well-known talk show host was asked one time, "Wouldn't you like to go to heaven?" And his response was, "No, I'd rather go where my friends are going." You would think that's an obvious question, but it's not. Not everybody wants to get well. Not everybody wants to be healed. Not everybody wants to be saved. And I believe that this shows us how much God grants people the power to choose their destiny. He is not willing that any should perish, but he's not going to drag anybody by the scruff of their neck, kicking and screaming, saying, "I don't want to go." So when Jesus asks these questions, yeah, he's being serious. Do you want to get well? Now, the end of the story is, Jesus said to him, "Get up, pick up your mat, and walk." And once the man was cured, he picked up his mat and walked. I don't know how happy he was about it, but he did. Jesus healed him, even if he didn't necessarily want to be healed at that point. Maybe he just didn't quite understand that Jesus could make him whole. Tom Wright shares an experience he had along these lines. And maybe you can understand or empathize with this situation. He says, "It took some weeks of persuasion before they came to see me. The grown son was desperate to get his ailing and depressed mother into some kind of a home where she would be properly cared for. As long as she lived with him, he couldn't do his own work or have any life of his own. She swamped him with demands for help and attention. We looked at several options. There were small communities, large communities, nursing homes, sheltered housing. Any of them would have been real possibilities. The mother, though, saw some flaw in each of them, which became to her fatal. None of them would do. After an hour, she turned to her son with a triumphant gleam in her eyes and said, 'There you are. He can't do anything for us.' The truth is, she didn't want anybody to do anything for her. She wanted to go on being a victim, putting moral pressure on her son and everyone else in sight to feel sorry for her." Yeah, there are folks like that today. We can offer them the help that Jesus can give, and they're not interested. And I believe that's why Jesus asked the questions that he did. To Bartimaeus, when he says, "What do you want me to do for you?" Implied in that is, do you want to give up your begging? Do you want to take responsibility for your own life? Do you want to have to work for a living? Bartimaeus knew the answer, but not everybody would have the same. And it's that insightful answer that we see in verses 51 and 52. The blind man said, "Rabbi, I want to see." "Go," said Jesus, "your faith has healed you." Immediately he received his sight and followed Jesus along the road. What Bartimaeus lacked in eyesight, he makes up for in insight. It's evident by the way he addresses Jesus. That might seem very normal to us. The NIV says, "Rabbi, I want to see." But that word that is translated "rabbi" only appears twice in the entire New Testament. The only other time is Mary, when she sees the risen Christ on Easter Sunday, and she says, "Rabbi." That particular Greek term is a very personal term. It could be translated "my rabbi." But it was something that the Jewish people did not like to use unless they were addressing God. And so for Bartimaeus here, for Mary on Easter Sunday, they're acknowledging, "Jesus, you are my God." And then he goes on to say, "I want to see." Literally, "I want to recover my sight." Bartimaeus was probably not born blind. He could see at one time, and then through an accident or an illness, he lost his eyesight. "I want to see again." The verb was also used in those days figuratively, meaning to look up. Meaning, I want to see, maybe from heaven's perspective. I want to see God. Who knows? Bartimaeus may have been asking all of this in that simple request. "I want to see." And the way the Lord responds, I think, is very telling. Again, in the English, it says, "Your faith has healed you," or "Your faith has made you well," depending on the translation. But again, when you get into the original language, the Greek verb there is sozo, meaning to save. And quite literally, Jesus said, "Your faith has saved you." Not only did he receive his physical eyesight, he was saved, forgiven of his sin, set free. He was given not only his physical vision, but a spiritual vision as well. One of the commentators that I was reading said he was given four eyes that day, right? Now, that really struck home to me because I've been wearing glasses since I was in third grade, so you could better believe I got called four eyes a lot in grade school. Any of you that had glasses at a young age knows what that's all about, right? But not only did Bartimaeus have that physical sight restored, he was given spiritual sight. He could see what really mattered. That same commentator also used the phrase "double vision." Well, those of you that know me, you know where my mind went there, you know. Great Foreigner hit from the 70s, "Double Vision." It was a great album. The song went to number 2 in the charts. But, you know, there's an interesting story behind that song. That song was co-written and sung by Foreigner's lead singer, Lou Gramm. And some years after they recorded the song, he literally began having double vision. And he went to a doctor and discovered there was a benign tumor that was growing and causing that double vision. He says, you know, how ironic. Guy that sings "Double Vision" has double vision. But what is great, kind of Paul Harvey's the rest of the story, is that Lou Gramm came to Jesus Christ, and he is still a follower of Christ to this day. So he did get double vision. By the way, that tumor they thought was inoperable, they were able to remove it, and he's been healthy ever since. So the Lord healed him as well. How wonderful the gift of Christ to give this kind of sight, to have 20/20 vision as well as the eyes of faith, to be able to see what truly matters, what is really necessary in life. It was an insightful answer that he gave. Now it calls to mind James 4:2, "You don't have because you don't ask God." Again, when Jesus asks us, "What do you want me to do for you?" Do we answer? Are we thinking, oh, well, you know, I'm not going to ask God for that? Maybe we don't believe he would really answer our prayer. Maybe because we don't see a way out, we figure God doesn't have a way out either. Maybe we feel unworthy or we're afraid we're going to be rejected. So we just remain stuck in the situation we're in. Jesus took an intriguing approach to blind Bartimaeus, asking, "What do you want me to do for you?" And Bartimaeus expresses a fine example of insightful faith, seeing where his eyes were failing and asking, I want to see again. I want to be made whole." And he received an answer to that prayer. It was his faith, evidenced by his persistence, that saved him. And that same faith made him a follower of Jesus. Notice it said that he followed him along the way. And I believe that the reason Mark included his name is because he continued to be a disciple of Jesus. He would have been one of the early church that would have been well known to the people Mark wrote his gospel to. It means a life of discipleship, following Jesus. And faith that does not lead to discipleship is not saving faith. Jesus did not go to people of his day and say, "Pray this prayer, and then one day you'll go to heaven." He said, "Follow me." That's the life of discipleship. It's an ongoing thing. It's not a one-time decision. It starts there, but it goes on. There's a continued action, and that continued action is following Jesus. Even on the uphill road to the cross. Now, before we leave that story, I'd like to go back a little earlier in Mark chapter 10. I had said earlier that Jesus repeated that question before. And it's in Mark chapter 10, verse 35. And amazingly, this is right after Jesus had told his disciples, "Look, I'm going to go to Jerusalem. I'm going to be arrested, tried, beaten, and eventually crucified." Right on the heels of that, then James and John, the sons of Zebedee, came to him. "Teacher," they said, "we want you to do for us whatever we ask." To which Jesus says, "What do you want me to do for you?" The same question, word for word. Exactly the same question. And what do James and John say? They replied, "Let one of us sit at your right and the other on your left at your glory." We want the positions of prestige and power. When you come into your kingdom, put one of us on your left and one of us on your right. Elevate us to the highest place. Jesus said, "You don't know what you're asking for. Can you drink the cup I drink or be baptized with the baptism I'm baptized with?" "We can," they answered. Jesus said to them, "You will drink the cup I drink and be baptized with the baptism I'm baptized with. But to sit at my right or my left is not for me to grant. Those places belong to those for whom they have been prepared." Same question, much different answer. Why? Because Bartimaeus knew what his need was. James and John didn't have a clue. Imagine the nerve, the gall, to ask Jesus, "We want to be at the highest place," right in front of the other 10. Because the next verse says the 10 were indignant, probably because they didn't think of it first. Let's get real. They're ticked off. "How dare you ask such a question?" Jesus probably felt the same way. How dare you? How dare you ask for something so irrelevant? What can I do for you? He asked them, and they're settling for some piddly position. Those who really know their need know how to answer. Jesus, I want to see. Jesus, make me whole. Jesus, save me. But until we see our need, we're not going to ask to be saved. And that's where Bartimaeus had insight without sight. He couldn't see with his eyes, but boy, he had insight that went far beyond even the 12. He understood who Jesus was. He understood what Jesus could do for him. And when Jesus restored his sight, he followed Jesus. He became a Christ follower. And I believe he continued that the rest of his days. I don't believe that it is a coincidence that you see this exact same question being asked in the very same chapter of Mark's gospel. I think there's definite theology being taught here. Jesus is asking, what do you want me to do for you? He's asking that today. He's asking that of you. What do you want me to do for you? What is our answer to that question?